You're listening to Good Sentences, the podcast that's guaranteed to tickle your literary ear holes and make you wish you'd listened to dear old mom when she said to put down those lawn darts and learn how to read. And now, here are your hosts, neither of whom listened to dear old mom. This is Craig A. Hart and S.J. Varengo.
Thank you for coming back on. I can't believe you braved us once again.
You guys are fun.
I told him the phrase that I can't believe you fell for it once again.
But. I fell for it once again. You know, you probably try to get me to say no is what I would say. Anybody who would have me as a member, I shouldn't belong with the...
Right, Groucho.
Yeah, Groucho, yeah.
I'm just so happy when someone invites me to something. Introverted people, we kind of like go, yeah, well, really nice if somebody invites you to something and you can just sort of go, yeah, I'd love to do that. I was impressed you guys asked me again. I was like, really? This is kind of cool. I must have done something right.
You were great.
Unfortunately for me, just timing and the insane schedule that Craig put together for doing the interviews for the old show, I only got to participate in a handful, but of the ones I did, yours was one of them, and I just had so much fun. I was like, this is going to be great. This is a great thing to do. If everybody's like this,
not everybody is.
And no, not everybody was.
We learned that lesson really quick.
Right. I have a character in the book that I'm working on right now that I use the term water from a stone to describe because he just does not know how to relate. And so he just says, like, so did you know so-and-so when you were younger? Yes.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And I understand I'm going to say certain actors very famous in Los Angeles for walking out on interviews, if even dare to mention something that is on his do not mention list.
Yeah.
Like, not ask me about this. He will get up and leave.
Right.
Yeah. So he's a one word answer guy anyway. So I figure I get to do half the job here. You ask the questions. I try to be, interesting and exciting and witty.
You're talking about us asking the questions, you answering them. We were hoping that you were so good on the last interview, this would be more of just a conversational visit.
Sounds great.
Absolutely.
To me.
Something you touched on last time, which was the creation of character and how important that is to the writing process. And you kind of led into it with talking about the project you're working on now with character. Do you think it's possible to overstate the importance of character to a piece of writing?
No.
Back to the one word answer.
Turning into one of those people, did you hear?
No.
Okay, so I will. Can I just riff on this for a few minutes?
You may.
Absolutely. In fact, in my prep notes, I use the word "get her to riff on character."
So I'm gonna delve into. I'm gonna mix up writing and fiction and theater. I have to approach it that way. So number one, I would say the best example of this is. You can say, oh, I like sci-fi. Oh, I like history. Oh, I like reading about, I like reading historical novels. I like reading mysteries, whatever. You gravitate towards a genre, perhaps, but you don't relate to the genre. You don't pick up a mystery simply because it's a mystery. You pick it up because something, you either know the character because it's a series, or something on that cover connects you to the human being having the human experience in this sort of extreme reality.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas we can just sort of go, okay, well, this morning I got up and I went to the store and I came home and it's an episode of Seinfeld, right?
Right.
But we loved it and it was very successful and very funny. But what you're really relating to, even on Seinfeld, is not, the soup Nazi.
Right.
It's the frustration with Elaine trying to get soup and George trying to get soup. And, so it's still character. Now, I love using Hamilton as this example, because whether or not you have seen the show, heard the show, you know of the show. It's kind of like seeing Harry Potter as an example. What Lin-Manuel Miranda did was he got us to relate to the founding father who began the treasury.
That's a pretty tall task right there.
And he got up at the White House and they expected him to do something. I think they expected him to do something from In the Heights. And he said, I'm going to do something from a show I'm working on right now. I'm going to rap about Alexander Hamilton. and you see the Obamas thinking this is hysterical. Right. And you see everybody in the audience going, what? Right. And then he starts, you know, how did can I use foul language? How did a bastard or son of a whore and a Scotsman dropped in the middle of a forgotten spot in the Caribbean by Providence, impoverished and squalor, grow up to be a hero and a scholar? Mm-hmm. And you're going, okay, I want to know.
Yeah.
This guy with nothing, you know, became this. And then through music, through all of it, we relate more and more to the characters. So, you know, you can have a great event. And my dad was really, really excellent with beginning with something happening instantly in that first sentence.
Right.
There's something happening. But if you don't relate to that character within that first sentence or two, you're kind of, okay, so it all comes back to that. When I was training as an actress, the same thing. You're starting with the words on the page, but what makes me special is how I interpret the wants and goals and desires and frustrations of that character and who I decide, guided by the written word, that character is to be. So to me, I don't relate to, I love reading stories about the Civil War. Okay, great. I love reading things that are set during World War II or during the Edwardian period or the Victorian period, or I like reading, you know, something that has a really good, exciting mystery. I like reading Eric Larson sometimes. Like but what I'm connecting to is not that. What I connect to is the character. So
there's a
wonderful author named Tasha Alexander, and she has a series of books that she's written about a character named Lady Emily. And Emily starts out in the very first book, her husband dies, and she believes it's murder. And she is someone who could have been very unrelatable in some ways. She grew up wealthy. Her mother's friends with Queen Victoria. She's not like she's runs in this circle at this time. But this woman is having this very real experience. Her husband has died. It looks like it's like everything's set up to make it look like it's like he got sick. And she's like going, this doesn't seem right. And so you're kind of like, well, why doesn't it seem right to you? You know, and you're connecting with this character, and we want to live vicariously, live through. We see somebody who's gone through something similar or something we hope never happens to us, but it intrigues us. And we want to see how they go through it and how they change, how they grow, how they handle the situation. It's the same thing for memoir. We read memoir because we want to understand that person's very human experience. We read fiction because we want to understand that character's very human experience that, you know, maybe is a little more exciting or frustrating or scary than our own, but it's, there's something about that that connects to us.
And you mentioned Eric Larson, how this applies also to nonfiction, how, you know, if he were just to say, oh, I'm going to write about, tell you what happened during X period of time, it might be interesting from an academic standpoint, but he turns it into art by the use of putting us into that time through characters and looking through the eyes of those characters.
One of my favorite nonfiction books, it's called The Speckled Monster, and it is about, it says it's a historical tale of battling smallpox is the subtitle. But what it really follows is, so you know, smallpox used to come in waves, and it would come through like every year, and it would wipe out people, right?
Yep.
And back in like, I think it's 1720, 1721, 22, 23, on both sides of the Atlantic, there was a doctor in America. There was a noblewoman in England who both started vaccinating people against smallpox. I guess you would say inoculating. She went with her husband who was, she had had the smallpox. She had been the most beautiful woman in the world. Like everybody would talk about Lady, I think it's Lady Montague Wortley, how stunning she was. So in my mind, I cast it with Nicole Kidman. But like just someone who's just truly, truly just like, oh my gosh.
Right.
And she had she was married and she got smallpox and she was completely disfigured and never went without a veil again.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But her husband becomes, I believe, ambassador to Turkey. And she goes with him to Turkey and she's a very interested woman and she's very excited and interesting. This is a true story. Mm-hmm. She decided to tour around Istanbul and she found this man who I believe was a doctor who was kind of sort of talking to her and telling her all about Istanbul. And she was learning and her husband was doing all the stuff he had to do officially. And they had a 3-year-old son and she wanted to go to the baths. So he found someone who could take her into the bath. So she's in there in her, you know, high collar, long sleeve, the whole thing.
Right.
And all these women are walking around naked and none of them are scarred in any way, shape or form.
Right.
And she can, you know, and they're naked, so she can tell.
Right,
and
right.
She says to the woman who took her in there, or she says to him afterwards, she's like, you know, why does nobody have smallpox scars? Because in England, everybody has smallpox scars, or most right. people do. And, you know, some people worse than others. And, of course, she's still wearing her veil. And he says, because we do this, and talks to her and teaches her about inoculation. And she wants to do this to her 3-year-old son. And her husband says, absolutely not.
Right.
You know, what intrigues us in this story is this woman in this early 1700s who's going, I'm going to become a doctor. And she goes back to England and she is pilloried. People are throwing things at her in the street, but then they're knocking on her back door saying, can you help me?
Right.
Can you help my children? So it doesn't matter what we're reading. We're relating to people. We're relating to each other. That's why the storyteller around the fire is the storyteller around the fire that everyone listens to.
Right, right.
It's because they're talking about people. And the reason why kids related to Hamilton, and then, I mean, my daughter's one of them. My oldest went, you know, had government senior year in high school. And really, really impressed her government teacher because she knew everything about the treasury.
Right.
The beginning of the treasury and why Washington, D.C. was the capital and why, like, and how that happened and about the Federalist Papers, the whole thing. And he's like, wow, he was really, really impressed with her. And she's just coming home going, yeah, it was Hamilton. It put it in her mind in a different way. And yeah. Because the kids related to it, the kids knew it. You know, and they remember it. And that's what every history teacher gets wrong. Like, it's, you know,
yes,
we want to know about 1776, but we really need to know that every single man in that room in Philadelphia signed the Declaration of Independence. But what did he sign? He signed his own death warrant. He signed a piece of paper that said, I am rebelling against the king. Put me to death if I lose. That's a whole different story other than this is the group of people who signed the Declaration of Independence.
Right.
Ben Franklin, who said we should all hang together, we should all hang separately.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So I think you can't separate good story from good character.
On the topic of character and somebody, a writer may be listening who wants to work on character, through your days as, you know, a writing coach, what is something that you could tell somebody to do, exercises or what is something to pursue to brush up on that a bit?
Well, they could go to my website and sign up under For Writers.
And they should. And they should.
That's a great thing. And my newsletter then. I would say there's three really, really big character things that every character has or does. Every character through the course of the story, for the most part, changes or nothing's happened. It might solidify an opinion, but they've gone through something to do that. And they will not go against what they believe, what they perceive to be their own best interests.
Right.
And I had a very interesting conversation when I was teaching my class at the Dallas-Fort Worth Writers Conference with a man who said to me, what about a Marine? Is it in his best interest to jump on a grenade? And I said, who in this room is in the armed forces? Three people raised their hands. And I said, could you please explain that better than I can? And they did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like they are so indoctrinated. By the time they get to active service, they are a unit. Their best interest is the survival of the unit, whatever extent that means.
Right.
So they will always do that. And then there is always a driving force, a desire, a want that a character needs that is what pushes them through the story. Harry Potter wants a family, you know? I mean, that's really, if you look at that arc of that character, he's driving forward, he's creating a family, he's wanting a family because some part of him believes it's possible despite the upbringing. And you might say, oh, that's impossible, but I meet people every day of horrid childhoods and fantastic marriages. So
right.
There's some element of belief that this can be better, but the way I'm being dealt is not the only possibility. And whatever that thing is that drives you through the entire story, there are pieces along the way. In every single scene, there is something that your character wants, and there are ways he's going to go and get it. Please don't hate me for using he, okay? I'm just using he like I'm going to use he, she, it.
Right.
If it's an alien blob, I'm just going to use he. Yep. So those three things, you don't go against your own self-interest, you do change, and you do have something you want more than anything. And if you've got those really, really clear, the rest of it is gravy. And you need to know other things. You need to know what their belief system is. You need to know what their morals are, because if you don't know where your morals are in your characters, you don't know how they'll react in a situation. Like if I think that honesty is the most important thing, I will not lie, or I will do everything I can in order to not lie.
Right.
You have to remember that the villain in your story is the hero in his own.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, that's good.
Mm-hmm. I hate to use it, but Hitler thought he had an answer.
Right.
Yeah.
He thought he had the answer to what was ailing his entire country and himself. It wasn't a good one. We didn't like it, but he did think he knew what was right. And so you can't develop your lead character without developing your villain as highly and as in depth. You have to know what your character's fighting against and what they're moving through. So, I mean, the character questions that I have that's in my website are ones that kind of help. You never know what's going to come up. Like sometimes I put something in the pocket of a character. One of the questions is, what's in my pocket? I've put something in characters' pockets that may never come out again, but I also know that at some point I might need it. So it might just get thrown in there in an earlier draft. It might stay there, come out later in the story. I realized in going through my current work in progress that I have a ring that shows up in the last 10 pages that's never anywhere else. So really need to fix that.
Right.
Writing myself a note right now because I forgot about the ring. And I did ring.
Craig and I will send you our collaborator's bill for helping you.
Thank you. So you're like, oh yeah, there's that ring. So I think that you can't delve enough, but if you're really looking for like the most basic three things, it's those. And then the morals are important because then right. You know how you're, and you know, or you know what the stakes are then. I mean, if you've got somebody who would never steal and has to, there, that creates a crisis, you know, a crisis.
A moral dilemma. Sure.
A moral dilemma. And do I, or if you have somebody who does something stupid, I mean, Dad wrote a short story called Unguarded Moment that is about a guy who skips work and goes to the track and talks his way into his boss's box. I believe he talks his way in. I don't think he was invited. And he's sitting there at the track and a man sits down in front of him in the same box. And he has a really fat billfold in his back pocket. And he gets up and he walks away and the billfold lands on the ground. And this guy drops the racing form over it. And his whole life goes to hell in a handbasket. And, you know, it was just this moment where he just did something stupid. He did something without thinking. You know, I was listening to My Favorite Murder today. I don't know if you ever listened to that podcast.
And no.
They were talking about, they talk about true crime. It's a true crime comedy podcast, essentially. They find a lot of humor. But this one guy escaped from jail 2 weeks before he was supposed to be paroled. Like 2 weeks, actually 2 weeks before he was done, he had finished his sentence, but somebody was leaving and he went along. Like,
oh my God.
So then you became a fugitive for 14 days? Like, why? now what do I do? Obviously, this guy had impulse control issues. You know, I think that that would be my basic thing is never go against your own self-interest. How is this character changing? And what does this character want above all else? And in each scene, what does this character want? And please don't always give it to them.
Right.
I think you touched on some really, really important points. And there's one in particular that I would like to expand on. It's this idea of the thing in the pocket. When you first said that, the first thing that came into my mind was, I know it's in there. The reader may never know it's in there, but I do. And everything my character does might be affected by the thing in his pocket. So my reader may never, ever, ever even have an inkling that there's something in his pocket. But me as the writer can use that invisible thing as a tool to motivate my character to do X, Y, Z, whatever.
Absolutely. As an actor, you have every character has a secret. And sometimes it's the driving force. Sometimes it's the thing that makes them do everything they do. I did a scene in acting class from His Girl Friday, which was originally a play called The Front Page, but we used the movie script, and the ex-wife comes in to speak to her ex-husband, and he tries to romance her back. Right. And she's going to go get married because she wants to settle down and have a baby. But the baby part isn't anywhere in the script. It was just in me.
Nice.
And
nice.
I was playing her because it wasn't just about leaving him. It was that being with him, that would never happen. They were reporters and they were crime reporters and big event reporters. And it was not going to stop. And so, you know, that thing can sometimes add something to your character. It could be something that they touch on. You know, the ring, I just need to add it about two other places and it will have a resonance that needs to be there, that can be there. And it means something to this character. I think anytime you get to add dimension, when you think about like, what do you put on every day? You know, I always have my wedding ring on. Like my wedding ring is always on. And the only time it's not on is if I'm in the ocean or I travel overseas, in which case it's in the bank. You know, and I wear a fake, but I always have a ring on my finger, and I am very aware when it's not there.
Yes.
It's been there for 29 years.
Yep.
So, you know, I'm going on 30 here. So it's like, it's a part of me. And that's the kind of thing that can inform a character. It could be, our younger daughter used to give us she used to give me a rock when I would go away, not even out of town. Like, I'm just going to drive in and get my hair done.
Right.
And she'd like, take this to remember me by. But then it was with me all day. You know, my stone from the yard was with me all day.
Right. Yeah, that's funny. My daughter gave me a stone once the day I started a new job. And I worked there for 8 years, and that stone never moved from where I set it the day I started.
Yeah. And nobody else needs to know that.
Right.
But it can be on your character's desk.
Right. You know, interesting thing with, you know, the characters and their motivation and staying true to themselves. I think we've probably all read books where the character does something completely out of character for no reason, and it destroys the suspension of disbelief.
Yes.
You can't quite buy it. Like, that wouldn't happen. And it destroys everything about the, like, you cannot go along with a storyteller any longer.
Yeah. And I, you find that with first novels, I think, and you find that with, sometimes you find that with series that then go to other people writing it other than the original.
Oh, yeah.
Like, oh, no, they wouldn't have done that.
Right.
They wouldn't have done that. Like, there's no point in doing that. We see it in television all the time. We see a character do something and you're like, what?
Yeah.
And any time you send your reader out of the story like that, you're losing them. I had this brilliant idea today. It's actually in my Instagram post from today. Certainly one of the last ones I wrote. I realized that in going through again, I was also being a script supervisor. And a script supervisor is a job in Hollywood. They're usually, if you're ever on a set, they're usually on a very short stool right next to the director. At least that was my memory. They write down everything about every shot, but they also write down, they also keep notes, like the director will say, oh, I like that one. And they're taking notes like that, but they're also taking notes of What side was his hair parted on?
No, yeah.
What color was the shirt? What right, time right. did the clock say at the top of the scene? What time did the clock say at the bottom of the scene? All that nitpicky detail work. And it's a job that you never notice unless it's wrong.
Right.
And when it's wrong, you are instantly taken out. So you can't have a woman open a door at noon and have her close it 2 minutes later at 6 p.m. Can't open in the bright light of day and close it as the sun is setting. It just does. It isn't there unless the door has been open the whole day.
Right.
And those things throw them out. I think it certainly throws me out. If I'm like going, wait a second, wasn't yesterday just Saturday? And now all of a sudden it's Tuesday, but it was yesterday, it was Saturday. I'm confused.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I have a character in one of my series that Craig's familiar with. And his basic function in my last book that I just released was to be comic relief. And it works well because the guy, from the moment we met him in the book before, is just a smartass. You know, that's what he does. The guy, he owns a chain of battery stores, and he's just lives in his mom's basement kind of guy, you know. But the husband goes in to get a laptop battery, and a book later, him and this guy are in Mexico trying to find an archaeological dig because they think they've found a Mesoamerican electric battery, okay, from like pre-Columbian era. And Neil, being the battery king, has to see this. As I'm writing the scene where they're arriving at the dig, and they end up meeting armed guards who are screaming at them in Spanish. And it is at that exact moment that they realize neither of them speak Spanish, even though they've driven to Mexico on an alcohol-fueled whim. But anyway, Neil turns to Dan and says, "What are they saying? Do you know what they're saying?" And at about that point, the guards start to catch on that these guys aren't any threat to them, and they start laughing. And the main guy says, "What I said was, what are you doing here, you son of a whore?" And Neil's immediate response is, "Oh, you were talking to Dan." Point is, even though that's obviously, you know, a setup joke, you don't bat an eyelash at Neil saying it because he's been a smartass from the moment you met him.
You've laid the groundwork.
Yeah.
It's important to say, it's like that to thine own self be true is true with characters as it is with human beings. And it's not that a character has to stay the same. You just have to know where their point is, where the point is that's going to flip them one way or the other. What is the thing that's going to make a character into a vigilante who's always been a peacekeeper? We all have our breaking point. And we all have those moments where all of a sudden nothing works. And that's when we change. That's when we grow. That's when we crawl back in a hole and, you know, hide away for the rest of time or whatever. But we change.
Right.
You know, things have to flow in a way. And I guess none of us would get up in the morning and, you know, automatically decide that we should. I'll put it this way. No marriage ends because of somebody else. The marriage ends because something was wrong in the marriage, and the somebody else is a symptom. And you, by the time you're looking at somebody else, you've already stopped communicating.
Right.
You know, we used to have this thing where you get really aggravated in improvs if somebody says "you always." You know, you can't, like, if you've gotten to the point where you're saying to your spouse "you always," you should be having the conversation before this.
Yeah.
You know, it just should have been something else. So I'm so glad you asked me to talk about character. I haven't had a chance to do that for a little while here. I was like, I've been doing other things.
And your website, as you mentioned, has this nifty 25 questions that will bring your characters to life tool, all for the low, low cost
of absolutely free.
Someone's name and email address.
Right. And you get a newsletter. You get like 6 emails, and then you get one a month. The 6 all have exercises in them that will help you with scenes and with character and with research. But I, you know, that came to me from working as an actress. Truly, I mean, I used those questions to develop the characters I played.
Right.
And then I started developing characters I wrote and using the same questions. And then I was like, this is a really good way of putting in a nutshell how to develop a character. And I see, you know, there are smaller lists and there are bigger lists, and there are certainly questions I could add to it. But I think that, you know, it's good if you come up with some on your own, too. If you sort of go, oh, well, wait a second. This isn't on here. This would be a good question to answer, because it gives you an insight into a person. I mean, I don't know what somebody would write if they were, like, writing my character down.
Right.
I met a really, really lovely author illustrator named Steve Bjorkman. And he and I met at the Society for Writers for Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, which I refer to as SCBWI, but nobody else does.
Everybody should. That's awesome.
There was a woman who told me about it like 28 years ago, and she referred to it as SCBWI, so I've never stopped. Okay. Anyway, we were having a chat and we were talking, and I just said that we started talking to him about picture books because I've got an idea and I have no idea about writing. It's like writing a haiku. Uh-huh. used to writing, you know, like Tolstoy. And so he was talking to me and asked me, and he said, you know, and I'm a little stuck. And I said, this is so helpful. How can I ever repay you? He's like, well, I'm a little stuck on the story that I'm working on. And he told me about it. And then I asked him three questions and he kind of looked at me and he went, oh, and I was like, yeah, you know, sometimes it's just somebody else asking the right question. And so that group of questions can be that somebody else for you.
Right.
Be the one that says, oh, wait a second. I never considered religion. I never considered whether there is one or there isn't one or what it's made of. And certainly if you're world building, there is some form of a belief system somehow. Whether it isn't one, there isn't one, or whether there is one. And I think, aren't we all world builders?
Yeah,
absolutely.
I don't think it's sci-fi. I mean, I've built an entire house in my book. I think it's helpful to have questions to answer because I think it makes you think and have more questions.
Right. And feel free to say no, but is there anything you can tell us about what your project that you're working on right now?
I am working on a middle grade mystery, and I will say that it takes place in the house that I grew up next to in Los Angeles. I lived in a very, very small, modest house. And next door was the enormous garage to the enormous house that was completely outsized compared to everything else around it. And it was older. It was an older house. And I've made it even older in my story. And so it takes place there. And then other than that, I will just say that I germinated this idea before the internet, and I have now had to add the internet to this book. That took me a really long time to figure out how to do that.
Well, I won't push you to reveal too much more because I know that probably, you know, like your dad and like a lot of other writers, talking about your project too much is scary because it sometimes means that that's the less writing that is done on the project. You dry up the well talking to other people about it rather than actually
you want to keep it mysterious. You want to have this element of surprise. But I think that I just feel like it's when it's in print and everybody can go buy it, then they can find out. But I'm happy to share this germination, this little moment of growing up next door to what I believed at the time, but I don't know that it was quite that big, was a 14-car garage. What I do know is that two of our houses, it seemed, could have fit in it. Our house was like, I think, 2,200 square feet. It wasn't tiny, tiny, but it wasn't big.
Right. Yeah.
And it seemed like two of our houses could fit in that garage. And there was one person living there.
Do you have any knowledge about who built it there and why?
I know exactly. I mean, I know of the family that owned the house and may still own it is the Montgomery family, and they owned all of this area, this shopping area on the Sunset Strip called Sunset Plaza. So in the 60s, when everything was in, and 70s, when everything was hot and happening on Sunset Boulevard in West Hollywood, it was like, you know, Filthy McNasty's and the Rainbow Room and all of that. This was a sort of, it's tonier now, but it was a shopping area, but there was like a drugstore and there was a veterinarian and there was probably a post office. But this family owned the whole, what is known as the Sunset Strip. They owned that. They owned the Sunset Plaza area of that and still do. And that was their house, you know. So that's what I'm working on right now. And I'm finishing it up, and it's going to go to someone who's going to read it probably the beginning of next week.
Oh, exciting.
Yeah, that's exciting to me. It was time to send it off to a play date and see what comes of it and not stress over it, except, you know, trying very hard not to wonder what somebody's thinking of it.
Right. Yeah. Good luck. I've never managed to do that, like not think about it.
Yeah. I'm not really good at that either. I'm kind of like, you know, my husband likes to say to me, where are your feet? And right. I'm like, they're right here. They're right here at the bottom of my legs, and I get it, but you know, sometimes it's a little hard to remember where your feet are when you're excited about something. So,
well, you're waiting on something from like that from somebody every day is like a year. Like, oh, the longer it takes, the more you're sure they hate it. They just don't want to tell me now. They're trying to figure out how to break the bad news.
How to break the bad news? But you see, the lesson in that is the lesson I got from my dad. In that when he was really hungry and writing and hoping to sell, and he was getting rejected and rejected and rejected and rejected, over 200 rejections before he sold his first short story, he always had a story out.
Yeah.
So he was writing one, and he had like three that were out in various places, so that when he got a rejection, there was still hope. And so my goal is that I will send this off and I will go back to work on the picture book. I still know nothing, but I have this idea that's very visual. So I'm learning.
Well, you do realize we're going to keep asking you on every now and until you say no. So just throw that on there.
I don't know that I'm going to say no. I enjoy speaking with you guys, and I like talking about the art of writing and character and all this thing. And I hope that the next time I'm on, I have really, you know, like exciting news about, you know, something being published.
Yeah, you know? Definitely keep us in the loop there, because we would definitely want to know about it. We can make a show dedicated to that. We're excited to see what you come up with.
That would be really, really fun. So thank you so much, you guys. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much. We'll talk again.
Good Sentences.
Welcome back. Craig and I are here with you once again after hearing all that incredible stuff that Angelique just shared with us. Speaking for myself, if I could interview Angelique Lamour every day for the rest of my life, I probably would.
And you'd probably never run out of stuff to say.
Exactly.
She's a wealth of information.
And what we want to do now is something that we're going to do as a regular part of our shows, hopefully, and that's take a little time to go over some of the stuff that we learned from Angelique, combine it with some of the stuff that Craig and I have learned in our own work, and present it to anybody out there who is an aspiring writer or maybe a little further along in your career. What I want to say is there's always going to be something at any point in your career that you might not have thought of,
right,
that someone else might be able to point out to you. And so, you know, like I said in our introductory show, Craig and I aren't coming to you from a point of view of, hey, listen to us, we know it all. But we have had a little experience with writing, I guess it's fair to say. So we'd like to share some of these insights with you. And we are going to be working off an actual document that you can get yourself for the low, low price of giving Angelique Lamour your email address and getting her incredible email newsletters on a regular basis. But when you first sign up, she will happily give you a document that she calls the 25 questions that will bring your character to life. She mentioned it during the interview. And Craig and I want to look at three of the questions on here and just riff with you guys about that a little bit. That
we want to pop in here real quick and say that I know what people are probably thinking, oh, another email list, I don't need to sign up for another email list. But this is one of those that you actually get value with every email that you get.
I'm glad you said that, because I will admit that I am notorious for it. I don't do it as much anymore because I learned my lesson, but I used to sign up for a lot of author email newsletters and found that the vast majority of them ended up just being something that I deleted unopened more often than not. But with Angelique's newsletters, every time I get one, I know there's going to be something in there that's going to help me as a writer. And I would encourage anyone to not be afraid to sign up for this email list, because you are going to be rewarded for it. So let's jump in. We're going to look at, like I said, three things from her 25 and just put them out there as things that we identified that are absolutely crucial for a writer to at least get their head wrapped around when they're creating their characters. And the first one's going to seem a little obvious, but physical appearance. What do they look like? You're going to want to write down for yourself a detailed physical description of at least your main characters. I would go far as to say maybe every character that appears in the book. I don't know how you feel about that, Craig.
Let me put it this way. You can't have too much information. So right. if you want to do it, then absolutely. But definitely for any character that sticks around for more than a page, you're going to want to know. And I say this as somebody who has a tendency to gloss over some of this stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm so excited to get into the action and to start telling the story that I do. Sometimes I'll have a picture of them in my head. And because I know what they look like, I forget that the reader may not.
Right.
So that's one key when you're writing is to keep the reader in mind because they are not privy to all the information that you may have.
And to some extent, they may never be.
Right.
Because a lot of these things might be something that at least where you are in the story now might not even come out. Mm-hmm. Some of the specific characteristics that Angelique mentions in her document are their weight, hair type, height, hair texture, hair color, eye color, skin tone, skin quality, facial hair, scars, clothes. All this stuff can be in your mind or better still on paper in front of you for you to refer to. And you might never make mention of the appendix scar that the character has, but it might come into play somehow, somewhere down the line. And if you remember, oh yeah, they've got a scar there.
Mm-hmm. Well, you just never know how it's going to impact the story. And here's the other interesting little thing about writing. There's something magical that happens when you are fully aware and intimately familiar and acquainted with the character you're writing about. That somehow, even if you're not mentioning specific things, it comes through in the writing, and the reader can pick up on this, on that, and they will relate to it, and they will become more involved because you are.
Exactly. I guess the way I would put it is think about if someone asked you to write about a real person that you know almost nothing about. Let's say there's a group of five people, and someone turns to you and says, write down a description of Larry. And this is the first time you've ever met Larry, you're not going to be able to write as detailed and as convincing a Larry as if you know, it was someone you'd known all your life. Now, obviously, a character that you're creating out of your mind, you haven't known all your life, but because you're this character's creator, you certainly are going to know that character better than anybody else in the world.
If you don't know them as well as if you've known them their entire life, then get to know them.
Yeah, because it's going to make it tougher for you the same way it would be if you were writing about a real person sitting across from you.
And all of these things that may seem kind of trite or like obvious, as you were saying, but the thing is where, hair type, texture, color, scars, for example, these lead to other things about them. So, for example, if they have certain scars, that opens up an entire world about where did they get these scars? What is their background that got them into those situations where they accumulated these, what are their battle scars or surgery scars, whatever they are? That tells you a whole lot more about the person rather than they just have a mark on their body.
It sure does. It sure does. And, a scar is something that someone else might see and be able to identify this person with. There's just a zillion things you could use these details for. So, to wrap that one up, as much physical information as you can gather about the character that you're creating, the better off you're going to be as you move forward. Next question we would tackle would be, what does the character want? Mm. What's their overall desire? What drives them?
That's huge.
I mean, how crucial is that, Craig?
That is the germ of pretty much every story. What is driving a writer? What is motivating? The motivation for the protagonist and even the antagonist. Now, I do want to talk about that a little bit because Angelique made an amazing statement I want to bring in. But what is the motivating factor for these main characters? That is the story.
And everything is going to hinge off of that. And it may not be something that the character even knows when the story starts.
Yeah.
I would have to say, I'm just running through my own works in my head, just about every one of my stories, to some extent, when they start out, the main character has no idea the desire that they're going to end up with. And I'm thinking specifically of the Sarah of Quadar stuff, because the first book starts out with a girl working on a mountainside far away from everything she loves and hating everything about her life. She ends up being the savior of the planet. So this is obviously someone who didn't know what she wanted that moment was not going to be what she wanted forever. What she wanted that moment was to be dancing with cute boys instead exactly. of standing on a mountainside with a foul smelling animal, you know.
Right.
But I would say with some confidence that by the time the first three books end, that's no longer her primary concern.
Right. Well, and having read the books, I know you do a masterful job of using a character arc to change a motivation.
Right.
So that's key in that whatever, if even if you do know what you're starting out with, it doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be what you end with, as long as you have a clear transition within the course of the book or the series to make that happen. I mean, you can't just automatically change it, you know?
Right, right.
But you did a masterful job of showing how that happened, and it came across as very natural and obvious. Of course, that is what would happen, and so it's easy for the reader to accept.
Well, thank you for that. The recognition that I pulled that off.
I didn't even get paid to say it either. So what do you mean?
But if you buy lots of books, we'll both get paid. So
right.
At every step of the way, you want to have your finger on the pulse of what that character wants and realize as you go that it's probably not going to be the same at the beginning of your story as it is at the end, at least if you're doing it right, I suppose. The last thing on the list is, what is the character's secret? The one thing they don't want anybody to know. Right off the top, this sounds to me like something that could potentially never be revealed to the reader.
Yep, could be.
But absolutely is going to move the story in a certain direction. Obviously, it could be something that the reader learns on page one too, which makes, you know, these tools so terrific, is you can do with them what you want to do with them.
Right.
You can adapt them to your style, to your story, to your characters, you know, and one of the cool things about having a character with a secret is, if you do choose to reveal it, it can just be the most powerful moment in a story. Craig and I have a character in the stuff that we wrote together who is basically, what's the phrase, an enigma wrapped in a question. All we know about this guy basically is that he is a killer. Mm-hmm. And we don't know if he works for someone, if he works for himself, if he does it just because he likes doing it. But I will tell you this, he has crept into our everyday vernacular as someone we'd like to call on a regular basis to take care of business for us. And I'm referring to the Velvet Glove.
Yeah, as those of you who have read the Spyco novella series will be familiar with him.
Yeah, we basically love him because he's our opportunity to write a character that is completely deranged but kind of likable.
Right.
You
well,
know,
he's got these impeccable manners. He dresses yep. smartly, goes, you know, as a man about town. He just happens to cut people's heads off, you know. It's yeah. just a little detail there.
You know, everybody's got to do something for a living, right?
Right, exactly. Blow off a little steam, whatever.
Take off a little head, blow off a little steam. But we have had a lot of fun with him, and kind of what we've done is let little secrets show as we go with him. I don't think we've yet to reveal the full depth of his depravity, but we've showed some pretty depraved stuff.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I guess while we're talking about characters, that's one of the things I enjoy the most about writing, is I can create someone who is as perfectly moral as you can conceive, or we can create someone who has got no moral anchor whatsoever. For me, I consider myself a relatively moral guy. I mean, I'm not perfect by any sense of the word, but there's things I won't do. And as a writer, you can create characters who will do those things. And I think this number 25, What's Their Secret, plays big in that.
Maybe a good point to mention what I wanted to about Angelique talking about antagonists or the antihero or the villain in the story. Mm-hmm. And she said something that I've heard before, but she really, this is an instant when I hadn't thought of it in a while, and she brought it back. And I was just like, you know, that is so true. And that is, the villain in your story is the hero in his own.
Right.
So that villain thinks he's doing the right thing, generally mm-hmm. speaking. You know, his code or whatever he lives by, if there is something, it may not make sense to us, but he has a structure of his own. And that's what makes him human. And I'm guilty of this as well. And a lot of people, I think writers, it's a pitfall we go into pretty easily, where we don't give the same attention to the villain that we do to the hero.
Yep.
And that's a mistake. The more dimensions your villain has, the more important the hero's struggle against that villain will be. And that being the point of your story. And that's why it's important to get that right.
And again, you know, the more detail you have, even if it doesn't go on the page,
yep,
your readers are going to know it's there. They're going to feel it's there. And I agree, too, specifically about the antagonist, Craig. In the cleanup truth stuff, my antagonists have become, as time goes by, a lot more multidimensional than they were in Bucharest. In Bucharest, I basically, my main bad guy was a cardboard cutout. I'll say it myself. He was a horrible man doing horrible things, and he was basically there so that we would hate him. Now, in the next two books, the main antagonists have been every bit as hateable, but I've put a lot more work into how they got where they are. For me, it was easier for my main character to deal with these people because I knew what made them tick.
You know, it makes a huge difference. And the other thing about The Secret is it doesn't necessarily have to be an obvious thing. For example, there are war books, for example, where the main character's secret is that he's a coward.
Right.
And he doesn't want to go into battle, doesn't want anybody to see his cowardice. But it can be a lot more subtle than that, or even, perhaps I should say, a lot more obvious than that. It would be a better way to say it. And that, for example, in my Serenity series, Shelby Alexander, his desire is to just to retire, be quiet. He's led a fast life. He's ready to stop, settle down, be done with it all, and trouble continues to find him. But his right. secret, in my mind, is that he is getting old.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't want anybody to know it. I mean, it's obvious he is because outward appearances, you can tell he's slowing down. But in right. his mind, as long as he's not put in situations where it will become obvious, he can keep the fact that he's getting old a secret from the world at large.
And maybe even on any given day, convince himself that it's not right. true. This is certainly an experience that I can relate to. My next birthday, I'm going to be 60 years old, but in my head, I'm still a stupid 18-year-old with stupid 18-year-old mental capabilities. That's why I still laugh every time someone says, "Let me tell you about what you do." Right. As soon as that happens, I'm gone, you know.
Well,
in fact, that very thing happened at our Christmas Eve family gathering the other night, and I don't think I've ever seen more people stare at me disapprovingly, but someone said, "What you do," and that was it. I lost it. And I think that's part of what is making it still fun for me as I'm approaching all these adult things with my adolescent mind, trying to work it out. But yeah, that's a perfect, Shelby's a perfect example of someone, I mean, whose secret is obvious to him. And at the same time, it's the one of the most important things for him is to keep the secret, even though the reader knows it pretty much, you know, as he eases into the character Shelby in the first book, you're like, okay, I get where this guy is. He's hoping to be in a comfortable place in his life where he doesn't have to deal with all this crap anymore. And here it is falling right in his lap. And as the books have gone by, you've done now is my turn to praise you. You've done a masterful job of gradually making it more and more an issue with each book. Mm-hmm. And I guess at some point he's just going to decompose in front of us or something? I don't know.
Takes an aim at a bad guy. His arm just falls off. All right. Guess it's time to hang it up. Don't your body parts start randomly falling off. It's time for the roll recliner.
One of those motorized ones that goes back slowly, too, because right. I don't want any of that jarring recliner going on.
Threw my head off the last one. I thought the velvet glove had popped in for a visit.
Well, so hopefully that'll give you the aspiring writer, the journeyman writer, the experienced writer, just a little food for thought, give you some idea of the sort of stuff that we're going to be doing on the Good Sentences podcast. And thanks for checking us out.